Yesterday, civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks died in her home in Detroit, Michigan, at the age of 92. In 1955, Rosa Parks triggered a movement that changed America when she refused to give up her seat on a public bus in Montgomery, Alabama. That same year, she described what happened in an interview with Sidney Rogers, this from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
I want to make very certain that it is understood that I had not taken a seat in the white section, as has been reported in many cases. The seat where I occupied, we were in the custom of taking this seat on the way home, even though at times on the same bus route, we occupied the same seat with white standing if their space had been taken up, the seats had been taken up. And well, I was very much surprised that the driver at this point demanded that I remove myself from the seat.
Rosa Parks' defiance sparked organized resistance. A young minister named Martin Luther King Jr. was among those who organized a citywide boycott. For more than a year, African-American citizens of Montgomery refused to ride the buses that many relied on to get to and from work and school and shops. Eventually, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the segregated seating policy was unconstitutional. At the time, Mrs. Parks had no idea that her actions would ignite one of the most dramatic episodes of the civil rights movement.
I think this came about because the ministers were very much interested in it, and we had our meetings in the churches, and being the minority, we felt that nothing could be gained by violence or threats or a belligerent attitude. We believed that more could be accomplished through the nonviolent passive resistance. We had no quarrel with anyone. We only want to stop riding the buses until we are treated as any other passenger.
Rosa Parks, speaking in 1955. She died yesterday at the age of 92. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll take your calls and questions, comments about the life of Rosa Parks. We'd particularly like to hear from those of you who were involved in the civil rights movement or the bus boycotts. Our number here is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Fred Gray was Mrs. Parks' lawyer after she was arrested in Montgomery. He joins us now by phone from his office in Detroit, Michigan. Good to have you on the program, Mr. Gray.
Thank you very much. I'm in my home in Tuskegee, Alabama, which happens to be the birthplace of Mrs. Parks also.
Oh, I apologize for the error. I understand you had lunch with Rosa Parks that day when she was arrested.
I had lunch with Mrs. Parks that day and had been having lunch with her about a year from the time I started practicing.
Did you have any idea?
Unusual for us to have lunch.
No, I wondered, did you have any idea that she was about to defy the bus segregation law?
Well, we had discussed the problems on the buses because we'd had problems on the buses in Montgomery for many, many years. And some of those problems were contributing factors toward me deciding to go to law school and to do civil rights litigation. We had talked particularly about Claudette Carvin, a young 15-year-old high school student who had been arrested 9 months before Mrs. Parks under similar circumstances. And Claudette had been a young lady who attended Mrs. Parks' youth activities with the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young lawyer, I was involved in all of those activities. So we discussed those matters. We discussed the fact that something needed to be done in Montgomery about the buses. And we recognized that the time may very well be right to do something.
After her arrest, I understand you met with her in jail.
Beg pardon?
After she was arrested, I understand you met with her in jail.
No, that's incorrect.
Oh, how did that go then?
No, we had lunch around noon.
Right.
She knew that I had an appointment out of town in the middle of the afternoon, but would be back shortly. When I returned, which was about 6 or 5:30 in the afternoon, I had a phone call from Mrs. Parks and from my secretary indicating that Ms. Parks was trying to get in touch with me, and then Ms. Parks called and had left word for me to call her. I returned her call. She told me about her arrest, asked me if I would come over to her house and let's discuss the matter because she wanted me to represent her in a trial which was then set for the following Monday. This was Thursday.
And that Monday was also the first day of the bus boycott. Mr. Gray, we have to take a short break. Can you stay with us?
Surely. If you can speak a little loud, I can't hardly hear you.
Oh, I understand. We'll turn up the volume on the line going back to your telephone there.
Thank you.
We should be able to clear that up for you. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the life and legacy of Rosa Parks, who died yesterday. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about Rosa Parks, known as the mother of the civil rights movement. Mrs. Parks died Monday in Detroit at the age of 92. Our guest is Fred Gray, an attorney who represented Rosa Parks after the Birmingham bus incident, and of course also, as he was telling us before the break, her friend. And Fred Gray, I did want to ask you, was she aware of the implications of what she was doing that day?
I think she was basically aware of what could have happened if she did what she did. And you mentioned that it was Birmingham, Alabama. It was Montgomery.
Of course, my mistake again.
Yeah.
And but she was aware that, of course, the day of her trial was the first day of the bus boycott.
That is correct. That was on the 5th, which was the following Monday.
And was that planned in advance in any way?
Was what plan?
The boycott.
Well, we had talked about having a boycott. We certainly had talked in detail about that possibility 9 months ago when Claudette Colvin was arrested. And Mrs. Parks was fully aware of that. And I had represented Claudette in connection with that case.
Why do you think then it was this moment that the movement took off?
Well, I think there were several things. One, in order to have something like this occur, you have to really do all of the planning that needs to be done, and you have to be able to do it in a short period of time. When Claudette was arrested, we had no indication that she was going to be arrested, but when she was arrested, I was called and I represented her, and we had meetings with bus company officials and with city officials in an effort to resolve the matter with the local African-American leaders. We were promised that conditions would be better, so we simply did not proceed at that time. But we also recognized the fact that there had been incidences before this and that there would be an opportunity if things did not improve. They didn't improve. We later found out that Mary Louise Smith, another teenager, was arrested under similar circumstances in October. We didn't know about Mrs. Smith's situation because her father simply paid a $10 fine, and that was that until Mrs. Parks' arrest. And I think we all concluded that we've had problems on the buses for many, many years now, and if we're going to ever do anything, now is the correct time to do it.
Let's get some questions in from listeners. This is Henry. Henry's calling us from Berkeley, California.
Hello. Yes, Henry. I was just reading in the newspaper this morning and then the interview with Rosa today, and I didn't quite – I missed something. The newspaper said that there was a section, the four rows reserved for whites, and then there was an intermediate section that if there were whites sitting there, the blacks had to move and further to the back of the bus. But then in the interview with Rosa, she said, from what I got, was that she was sitting in this interim section and that she had said that whites could stand and that if the blacks were sitting there, and I think she said this, they didn't ordinarily have to move, and she was surprised that the bus driver made her do this. So I was just wondering if that's my take is correct. And also, it seems as if she just... it was more accidental and certainly not intentional on her part to be obstinate, that she was just following what she thought was the custom. And the bus driver forced destiny upon her. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Henry. Fred Gray, can you help us out?
Yes, I can. Actually, I was the last person who talked with Mrs. Rosa Parks, who had any connection with the planning of the bus protest on the day of her arrest, because we had lunch that day. Mrs. Parks was fully aware of the fact that if she or any other African-American were to sit in any of those seats, and a bus driver would ask them to move, even though they may not have been in the reserved 10 seats for whites, then the police, bus driver had police power, and he had the legal authority to ask them to move from any of the seats. And that's what happened. She was aware that that could happen. So she, like anybody else, was not interested in getting arrested. But she also recognized that there comes a time when these situations develop that you just decide that you've had enough and you're not going to take any more, and you take the consequences in order to stand up for the basic principle that you believe in. Of course, on the whole question and the entire story of what transpired and the entire conversation between me and Mrs. Parks during our lunch hour has not fully been talked about nor written about. She has written in her book a part of the story. I have written in my book, Bus Ride to Justice, a part of the story. We had concluded that at some point in time, the two of us would probably jointly write the rest of the story. Unfortunately, she has now been ill for some time, and the last time I saw her, which was a little better than 3 years ago, she even then was not in a physical, not mental position really to do anything. So at some point in time, we'll get the rest of the story, but it won't be on this program today.
Well, let me just ask you, based on what you've just said, did you expect that this would happen, if not that day, shortly thereafter?
I was not surprised. And I would not have been surprised if it had happened to some other African-American. It had happened to Claudette. It had happened to Mary Louise Smith. And I was not surprised that it happened to Mrs. Parks. If she was sitting in a seat and the driver asked her to move, I knew that if she felt that she wasn't going to move, she wasn't going to move. And her quiet spirit and determination would have been that I'm simply not going to do it because I have a right to be here. It paid her fare just as others has paid it. And that's very consistent with what she said in the part of the interview that you played earlier.
Yeah, yeah. I just have to say at this point that the rest of the country, indeed the world, has a pretty strong interest in your continued good health.
Well, I hope to live a long time. The doctors say I'm in good health. I work every day, still practicing law, still doing the same thing that I've been doing for the last 50 years. And I'm just delighted that Mrs. Parks did what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And on behalf of the people of Tuskegee, and this happened to be her birthplace, and on my own behalf, I really want to express our deep sadness for her passing. But I'm honored to have been her first civil rights lawyer. I'm honored to have been her friend. And she made an outstanding contribution not only to our city, our state, our nation, but to the world.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Eric. Eric's calling us. He's on the highway in Florida.
Yes, how are you doing today?
I'm well.
Well, just a brief story. Back in 94, I was living in Anchorage, Alaska. Rosa Parks came into this wonderful school restaurant. I had my two-year-old daughter with me at the time, and she was there to receive an award. And just meeting her was an honor, but it was more important that my daughter, even though she didn't know who she was, got a chance to sit on her lap, get a hug from her, and get a picture by her. And to this day, my daughter's 11, still brags about she got to meet Rosa Parks. And that is one of the highlights of my life and my career. And I'm sorry to see her pass, but that's something that I can take and my daughter can always pass on to her children. I just wanted to mention it was just a wonderful, wonderful visit, and this is 94, and say her health was ill at that time also, but she took the time out to hug my daughter and give her a kiss and sit on her lap. So it was just a wonderful, wonderful story I had to pass on.
Thanks very much for that, Eric. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fred Gray, of course, your friend remembered for one moment, but lived a long life where there were many moments like the one that Eric was talking about.
He did, and one thing about her, and this was true before, during, and subsequent to her arrest, she was concerned about young people. That's why she was director of the youth program of the NAACP. And her whole concern, and even after her arrest, and when she founded her foundation, the last major trips that she made was each summer she would take a group of young men and women, high school kids and elementary kids, who would come through the South, see the various areas, and she really had an interest in children. And I think that's another legacy that she has left, and our children need to learn about a person like this.
After her arrest, of course, she became famous. She also became a lightning rod. Was this difficult for her?
No, she really didn't like a lot of fanfare, but she recognized that it had come with what she had done. So she graciously received it, but it was never one of those things where she would go out and tell you that she was this great civil rights leader, or that she necessarily intended to start a great civil rights movement.
Yet this sort of fame, particularly in that time and place, these things could be hard on your family.
Well, that's true. And she did suffer as a result of it. As a matter of fact, where she was working, they didn't fire her. But what they did was decided that that job was no longer necessary as a seamstress, and it was sent out to other persons on a contract basis. But the black community couldn't complain because it was sent to a black man who was doing the kind of work she was doing. But the bottom line is she couldn't get gainful employment here, and that's when she went to Detroit, and we are all thankful to Congressman Conyers, who came to her rescue and gave her a position in his office, and she remained there until she retired.
And, yes, that's where Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Fred Gray, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Fred Gray is an attorney and veteran civil rights lawyer, and he joined us by phone from his office in Tuskegee, Alabama. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Late in her life, Rosa Parks challenged the exploitation of her name, particularly in pop culture songs and in movies. Gregory Reed was her attorney most recently. He joins us now by phone from his home in Detroit. Nice to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here to speak in regards to Mrs. Parks as well. And I'm glad that you had communication with Fred Gray, who had stood by Mrs. Parks during those earlier years.
Now, you were involved in a couple of lawsuits in which she was a plaintiff, one against the rap group Outkast. What was that about?
First of all, I have been representing Ms. Parks for about 15 years.
I see, okay.
1990. And she had brought this to my attention when she was in church in Washington, D.C., a minister approached her and informed her that there's a song out with her name on it, and using her name and saying some, they have lyrics that are not so flattery to who you are, and you may want to look into that. And as a result, she contacted me, her and Miss Elaine Steele, who was her longtime companion and friend, asked me, that was the year 1998, to look into that.
Why did she feel that her name was so important?
Well, it's not... When you say her name, it's just like it's like anyone's name been marketed and exported without one's consent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not her name. It's just that it was that she was exercising her individual right and recognized that, that she would not want to be remembered or associated with lyrics for future generations who have yet to come, as well as this current generation, and thinking that, that she was associated with a marketing of a product. Her name was not used in any lyrics at all, but it was marketed.
I see.
A lot of people, and that was a misnomer in the media, and a lot of people could not grasp the distinction.
There was another incident, though, just a couple of years ago where she boycotted the NAACP Image Awards because of a line that was used in the movie Barbershop, where one of the characters, played by, I think, Cedric the Entertainer, said that all she had ever done was sit down. Was she worried that young people, primarily new generations, would see that and hear that, and that it was just too flippant about the struggles of the movement?
No, let's get back and we address both of those points, and so that your listeners can make the distinction.
And we just have a couple of minutes left, so.
And so one is that it was the misuse. It was marketing. The company, gives permission how a product is released. The same thing in the movie Barbershop. Her name was being marketed on 12 different products by the record company, in terms of exploitation of her name to generate profit and being associated with defamatory lyrics. And the barbershop was used just to draw attention. So it's not being used in a reverent way in terms of who she is and what she represents as a symbol of courage and freedom and peace in this country. So you have these media disseminating products just to draw in people, but it does not represent who you are.
Well, Gregory Reed, thank you for clarifying that. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Gregory Reed, an attorney at Gregory J. Reed & Associates. He joined us by phone from his home in Detroit, where, as he was telling us just a moment ago, he represented the late Rosa Parks for the past 15 years or so. She died yesterday in Detroit at the age of 92. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. Tapes and transcripts are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-TEXT.